Access number 27814, Mr. David Butt, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about various things, picking up on your time at Ganges. What about punishments, so, I mean, individual or class? What sort of... Because you mentioned Laundry Hill.
That's right.
What else?
As I say, I didn't, as far as I can recall, get into any particular individual punishment for anything. But class punishments were not infrequent for various reasons, either individuals, misdemeanours, and they punished the whole class. That was to try and give the individual a sense of responsibility, I suppose, and ridicule on occasions, because they upset everybody. And a lot of these punishments, of course, would be in what would have been make and mend time. But class punishments, I mean, they could have been maybe from just running around the playground, or doubling, as it was called, doubling around the playground for whatever length of time they felt fit, maybe doubling around with a rifle, and sometimes rifle over your head for a length of time, or a rifle out in front of you until your arms were practically dropping off, this type of thing. But that was fairly mild punishment, I suppose, compared with doubling up and down Laundry Hill, which is notorious. It was just a hill outside where the laundry was based, and it was fairly steep, and it was very tough if you had to double up and down Laundry Hill. Particularly on occasions you had to wear your oilskin. Again, we might have a rifle, or they might give you something else to carry, even heavier. At one stage, you had to do that with a gas mask on, and we did have to do that, but they were very, very careful about that, because I think they had a near fatality either months or years previously, where a kid actually did pass out. It got quite serious, I think, because he was doubling up and down with a gas mask. That may have been Laundry Hill, or it may have been the other punishment area, which was Faith, Hope and Charity, which were three flights of concrete steps which led down eventually to the boat pier, etc. And again, very hard. You were pretty fit, of course, then. Probably by then you were fit enough so you could do it, but it certainly wasn't comfortable. And if it was hot and you still had to wear a coat or something deliberately. Those were the sorts of punishment that would be handed out regularly to a class or maybe an individual. An individual was often more likely to be punished in full view of everybody else, so he'd probably get a playground punishment, doubling around with a rifle or whatever, just so that everybody saw who it was. Not that they took a lot of notice, because it was so regular that it didn't really matter much, but they felt it was just he was being penalised a bit more because he was in full view of everybody else. The ultimate punishment for anybody that was really, really did go against the grain, or could be possible assault on an instructor or swearing at an instructor or whatever, was what they call the cuts, and that in fact is a beating on the buttocks by the master at arms. That was not conducted in full view, unlikely for the old days. he was taken actually to the officers' quarters, or the punishment block, at the far end of the playground, and he would give them whatever number of cuts were deemed to be necessary. Six, I think, was the average number, and as I can gather from the kids that had it, it's pretty painful, and there's no effort spared to dishing it out either, you know. So it certainly was a deterrent from anybody who was on the borderline, but the real rebels, and as I say, that some of them never really changed that much. They were always rebels. Some of them managed to get right through training and still pass out. Some of them eventually got kicked out altogether if they were that bad. But funnily enough, it wasn't necessarily the rebel that came in as a boy from Borstal or whatever. It could be just a normal kid that had just reacted against the training and just couldn't take it, and then he would rebel in any fight, any way that he felt he could, you know.
Now, what about, was there a canteen or any, you know, for you?
There was a canteen.
I presume it'd be a dry canteen, was it?
Oh yes, oh yeah, very much so.
And what did the canteen offer you?
Not a lot. I mean, the very few occasions when you could go to it, which was probably on a Sunday afternoon, maybe if it was a make and mend, the canteen would be open. I mean, basically, all you could get was maybe a bar of nutty, possibly a sticky bun, tea or coffee, and they sold cigarettes. Now, if you did smoke, and everybody tried it, I think, at one stage or another, you might be able to afford, if you saved up your weekly money, say 1 or 6 a day for the first 6 months, and then 2 and 6 a day after that. 1 or 6 a week, and then 2 and 6 a week after you were made up to first class boy. You could afford a packet of 5 weights of Woodbines or something like that, I think. Basically, I think that was it. It was just that it was away from the other parts of the camp.
Anything in there, you know, a pool table or dartboard or anything?
Not that I recall, no. No, you had nappy girls, of course, which was a treat, I suppose. From that point of view, well, whether the girls or older women, I can't remember now. I think there was one of each a lot of the time when I was there. But no, there was very little, nothing that I can recall in that respect. You had, as I say, all the sports facilities and that elsewhere. So,
what about going out in the evening? I mean, yeah. You just said you've got no money. So, I mean, were you allowed out at all?
You weren't allowed out. No, you had a very occasional weekend where you could they would bus you into Ipswich. I can't remember how frequently that was. It wasn't all that often, and most kids didn't bother to go because they got no money anyway. So it was a complete waste of time. You might just as well go and, you know, play sport or whatever, keep yourself occupied. There were the occasional weekend you were allowed out, but it was very few and far between, and really not worth going.
Yeah. Now, what happened at the end of your time then? You had your exams, anything else?
No. Nothing really. I mean, it began, I suppose, to relax a bit towards the very end when you got to exam time. The instructors were more friendly. They were beginning to treat you like you were in the Navy, as opposed to being in Ganges training. And really, it's really then just a matter of doing the exams as and when they came along, and they were phased, depending on the discipline. And then the anticipation of getting your draft instructions, where you were going to go. That was the bit that everybody was really looking for at that stage. I can't recall whether we actually went on leave.
No big passing out parade.
Yeah, there was a passing out parade just for the divisions that were going. It wasn't, obviously, not everybody. It was just the classes, each class of that age group. Yes, there was a passing out parade.
Was it memorable or?
Not particularly, I don't think. It was just like any other parade. I think you were congratulated by the commander, captain of the Ganges, on passing out. Everybody congratulated everybody else, and then you went off to whatever was your destiny. I think, I can't remember. We went on leave. I think we must have gone on leave from there and then come back to our draft.
Now, where was your draft to?
And my draft was to HMS Rocket. It so happened that, of course, the king had died while I was at Ganges, and Queen Elizabeth came to the throne, and it was the Queen's coronation. So they had the Spithead review, massive review then, and I'm not sure whether it was larger. I've actually got a plan somewhere of the whole review, which I sent for.
This is in what, is it June 1953?
This was June 1953, yeah. So I was sent to HMS Rocket, which was a frigate. It was actually in the Londonderry Squadron. But she was one of the classes, a relay ship, responsible for relaying signals down the line to about 72 different ships, either naval or merchant, within visual range of the rocket. That was, I forget how many of us went, there were quite a number because they had to supplement the initial company.
This is just a temporary posting for the review.
Temporary posting for the review, yeah. They had to supplement the ship's own complement of communicators because of the fewer volume of signals that they were going to handle. So we were thrown into the deep end, and you had signals coming at you from all directions, and you learnt pretty quick what it was all about. But that was purely 5 weeks. Britannia didn't exist at that time, so the Queen was in a merchant vessel on the actual review itself.
Now, how did you cope with all these signals? Well, there must have been a lot of signals, wasn't there?
Well, there was a lot of signals. It never stopped. Obviously, we were in watches. A number of you on watch at any one time, and basically it was a matter of if you were on watch, you saw a light flashing or somebody calling up a semaphore or a flag signal. If you happened to be there, you accepted it. If you felt you were capable of coping with it at that stage, depending on what it was, you would do it on your own. If not, you would call one of the more senior fellows from the ship's crew, or the chief yeoman or yeoman or whoever is there, to help out. But gradually, as you built up your confidence over that 5 weeks, you felt you could do more. And of course, you had to send as well. So again, you had quite good practice in actually sending 7-4 or by light or hoisting flags. On a regular basis, solidly for those 5 weeks.
Did you cope all right? I mean, so
oh yeah,
I
think
it's
so.
A deep end of this, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I think we coped all right. You felt very apprehensive because it really was in the deep end. But you knew there was somebody senior there. The Ganges, ex-Ganges boys probably only had maybe two in a watch with the ship's company communicators, so you weren't on your own, but you were left to do it because it was so busy that they were probably dealing with a signal from somewhere else or sending something. We coped. And as I say, it was a good grounding, I think.
Now, what did you think of the review? Do you have any memories of it, the size of it?
Well, it was the size of it, yeah. I mean, there were just ships, as far as I could see, hundreds of them. And to think that, you know, that was the size of the Navy at that time, you know, it was quite amazing, I think, to us. I did forget to mention, while we were at Ganges, we did one day at sea on the destroyer. We did a few signals, I think, at that stage, but it wasn't much of an exercise. We were just sent out on a destroyer and back again at the end of the day. So, you know, you knew what the ship was like, basically, inside. So that's 5 weeks. You didn't get much time to see the inside of it very often.
And you were just in the Spithead area?
It was entirely in Spithead, yeah, between the Isle of Wight and Portsmouth and Southampton, as it was this year. It was quite awesome to think of that number of ships, plus all the merchant ships and foreign ships that were invited to attend. And probably, basically, because when we first got onto the rocket, I think, you know, there was only a few ships, and it gradually built up day by day, right up to the, you know, the actual review itself at the very end of the 5 weeks.
So you were there June to July, basically?
Yes. I think we probably left in July, left the ship then. Can't remember the actual date of the review. We'll put it down here.
Anything else about that, your time? I mean, as you say, it was just basically the review.
It was just the review. Obviously, the mess deck was very crowded because of the additional staff, us in particular. The mess deck normally takes the number designated to staff a ship of that size. So as soon as you get extra people, and this happened in fleet exercises much later on as well, then mess decks got very crowded. You had people sleeping, apart from in the hammocks, on the table, under the table, on camp beds and all sorts of things. And that's really what it was like, I think, on the rocket, because there were so many bods there.
Your next big thing would be your proper posting. That was the HMS Ain.
That's right. Then you got the detail. I can't remember, to be honest, whether we were told at Ganges that we were going on the rocket and then to the Ain. I think we probably were. So at the end of that 5 weeks, you know, you were going to be transferred. And HMS Ain, of course, was in the review, so we were transferred by motorboat. You just up, stick with your kit bag and everything else, jumped in a motorboat, went a few hundred yards down Spithead, and disembarked the boat back onto the HMS Ain. And that's where you started your naval career.
And that would be in July.
That had been in July.
53.
Yeah.
And you were on it for a year, till August 54. Now, what squadron was she in? Was she in a destroyer squadron with the home fleet?
She was in the HMS Ain, I think, was in the 12th destroyer squadron.
And it's the home fleet?
That's the home fleet, yeah.
And where was it based, or was it just...
We were based in Chatham, because I was a Chatham rating at that stage. The Navy tried, although not 100% successful, tried to allocate the bases according to where you lived. So if you lived in London, you were almost certainly going to be allocated to Chatham. Didn't always happen. Some people were sent to Devonport, Portsmouth, and you had people from Scotland who should have been based in Rosyth, or actually in Chatham and other places. I was based in Chatham, so you were normally drafted to ships that were also based in Chatham. The AIM was based there.
What was your reception like when you went to border? How were you received? I mean, you know, what was your introduction to ships life with them?
You were received as basically what you were. You were still a nozzer as far as ship's crew were concerned. You had the fellas that would take you under your wing straight away and start showing you the ropes and trying to break it in gently. You had probably the younger ones that hadn't been out of bandages themselves more than a year or a couple, would, you know, play all the tricks under the sun, you know, just to see if they could catch you out.
What type of tricks?
Well, it's the usual old thing of sending you here, there and everywhere to collect things which were fictional. I remember we used to do it with these coders when they came on National Service and go up to the stores and get some glass nails and a glass hammer, because, you know, we've got to fix this sort of thing. And believe it or not, they would go. you know, and they try all these sort of things. And they say, you know, you've got to go and draw a bit of kit from the stores or whatever, and you'd go down there and you say to the storeman, oh, I've come to collect whatever. And of course they're all in on it, you know, and it would go from there and they'd start giving you things that, you know, you shouldn't, not supposed to have had, or, you know, you take it back to the mess and, you know, somebody else would be detailed also, what the hell have you got that for, you know, all this sort of thing. But it didn't last very long. As soon as you settled in, you became part of the crew.
Now, what was your mess deck like? Can you describe, you know, the environment, what it looked like, what it was like?
Well, I mean, basically, a mess deck is a metal box, if you like. I mean, it's often, you've got the port and starboard messes, of course, and quite frequently they were interconnected. Depending on the size of the ship, again, you had communicators on one side and you might have electricians on the other, on the mess deck on the other side, and it would be open to the passageway.
So you were in the communications mess deck?
In the communications mess deck, yep. That was frigates and destroyers you would normally have, and above, of course, you would normally have communications mess deck. Any really small ships, which we'll come to, then it could be a mixture. But no. Yeah, I mean, it was a metal box, basically. Full of pipework. You had cables, pipework above your head, running all over the place, cables coming up bulkheads, up columns. You'd have lockers around the perimeter. You'd have a mess table or two, depending on the size. And you'd have hammock rails. There were no bunks, certainly on those ships in those days. And you'd obviously been given a certain amount of training in sleeping in a hammock.
Well, tell us about what's the whole rigmarole of a hammock, because there's quite a bit of setting it up.
There's quite a bit.
Getting in it, sleeping in it, and putting it down.
Well, that's right. A hammock, basically, it consists of the canvas hammock itself, a thin mattress, a sheet and a blanket, realistically, and a pillow. And what they call stretchers, which is just a wooden bar, which keeps the hammock shrouds, the actual cords that you sling it onto the bars, it actually keeps them apart so that when you lay down, you don't actually get completely closed in by the hammock itself. That's what it would consist of, plus what they call the clews and lashings, which are the cords and the rope which lashes the hammer when you fold it. Every night you had to unlash your hammock and set it out and sling it on from the bars. Every morning you had to get out, fold the blankets in a certain way, of blanket sheets, long ways really, roll your hammock as tightly as possible. The clues would all be folded into the hammock, and then the rope lashing, you would have to lash around the hammock in a certain fashion. And basically your hammock was also a life belt if it was lashed properly, which is what was drummed into you when you were learning how to do it. This is your life belt. If it's not lashed properly, it will sink, and so will you. If it's lashed properly, it will keep you awake, keep you afloat for a certain number of hours. And then you had what's called a hammock netting, which basically just a little cage area in the corner of the mess deck, and everybody just stacked them on end into the hammock matting each morning. I found hammock very comfortable, to be honest. I liked hammock, I really did.
Did you have trouble with it at first, getting in and comfy?
Well, no, I mean, there's only one way to get in a hammock, realistically, and that's you hold above a bar above the hammock, and if it happens to be the cable trays or whatever, you hang on that, and you just pull yourself up and move yourself over and drop yourself in it. If you try and get in from the side, unless it's very low, which normally they weren't, 10 to 1 you'll fall out the other side or whatever. It is quite comical, and particularly when fellas came back drunk. It wasn't uncommon for them to fall out of the hammock as soon as they got in it. but yeah, I mean, pull yourself up and lower yourself in it is the only way. Getting out is easy enough. You just put one leg out, sort of tip out the side. I found them very comfortable. In rough weather, of course, it did sort of go up in the air and come down and leave you behind, and you'd come back and catch it up later and this sort of thing. But even that was more comfortable than the later stage when I had a bunk in another ship. That's even less comfortable because you're rolling side to side, and if you bounce up and down, you're coming down on a harder surface. So I really did enjoy the hammock.
Now, what was the shipboard routine like? We'll sort of pick up what life was like for you on there. I mean, were you organising in watches?
Yeah, you organised. I mean, you had the mess routine. You had a killick, i.e. a leading hand of the mess, normally.
Is that a leading seaman?
A leading signalman or a leading telegraphist.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. I was one, not on the AIM, of course, but later on I was one. And he was in charge of the mess routine, i.e. cleaning the...